Thank you all for coming. It's beautiful to look out across this room. As you may have gathered, we're not following the usual circle format today. We have the great honor and privilege of having Matthew Fox here as our guest speaker. And it's quite fitting in many ways. His life and his work are very resonant with what this space stands for. I'll do a quick introduction before handing over to Matthew to share insights from his journey. But by way of, this is like tip of the iceberg, you know, so I'm going to do my best to do justice, but it's kind of a losing battle. Matthew is a pioneering teacher, an activist, a prolific writer. He's authored over 30 books. He is an Episcopal priest and has been a member of the Dominican Order and was a member of the Dominican Order for 34 years. His courageous stance on things like the feminine divine, gay rights, the sacredness of our relationship to the environment, and other controversial issues of our time have sparked, in many ways, a spiritual revolution in this country. And I know that many people here in this room today have had their lives enlarged, their vision enriched, because of the work that he's done. Much of his life has been dedicated to reawakening the West to its mystical tradition, its mystical heritage. He is one of the early and most influential exponents of a movement called the Creation Spirituality, something that a movement that traces its inspiration back to Catholic visionaries like St. Francis of Assisi and Meister Eckhart. He's also an advocate of education reform, working with young people to develop a more holistic approach to learning. And he believes that by reinventing work, worship, and education, we can bring about a nonviolent revolution in our world. One of his most interesting projects here in our neighborhood is with inner city teens in Oakland through a project called Yalawe, Youth and Elder Learning Laboratory for Ancestral Wisdom Education. And the goal is to reinvent education from the inner city out. He's the recipient of many awards, among them the Abbey Courage of Conscience Peace Award. Other recipients being the Dalai Lama, Mother Teresa, and Rosa Parks. So quite a lineage of honor there. As I was reading about his work and contributions, you know, one of the images that came to mind for me was that of a tree, and very rooted in a particular place, the soil of a particular tradition, very rich heritage, and yet branches that extend very wide, fruit that everyone can draw nourishment from. There's something both generous and joyous, deeply generous and joyous, about his contributions and what his work stands for. And I came across this quote of his on joy, where he says, "Joy is not the opposite of pain and suffering. It is what sees us through both of these things." So it is a great joy to welcome Matthew Fox to this space. And we are deeply looking forward to hearing about your journey and the insights from your life. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. And what is your name?
My name is Pavi.
Pavi, glad to know you. And you're part of this family that draws us all together, so I want to praise the work you do here. It's a wonderful thing to gather silence and to gather the silence of young adults and some not so young. Intergenerational silence is a big part of intergenerational wisdom. And our species is yearning for both at this time, for sure. Meister Eckhart says, "Nothing in all creation is so like God as silence. So just for that alone, I thank you for the vision here to gather silence out of this emptying. So much new can be born. So it's obvious we're living in amazing times and critical times, critical for the future of this planet, critical for the future of our species. And clearly, we have to go deep. We have to go into our spiritual roots. And it's a beautiful thing that we have such a variety of them. When you go deep enough, you realize they're not in competition and they're not in contradiction of each other. As the French say, vive la différence. There's a beauty, a special beauty to each of the traditions. I myself personally have been deeply, deeply rooted by the Native American practices, sweat lodges and vision quests and sun dances. That I'm going to Sundance at the end of the month. And powwows. And just the songs and the drumming and the archetypes involved. Like Black Elk says that the drum is the circle of the universe. And to bring music out of the drum is to listen to the, I would say the first chakra of the universe, the sound, the ultimate sound of the universe. But all of our traditions have so much to stir up. There's just recently, I finished a book on Meister Eckhart. It's my third book on Eckhart, but my first in 30 years, so I think I was overdue. I want to share with you just one comment about it from Larry Dossey. Some of you may know his work. He's an MD who's done a lot of work on meditation and how the differences between people who have operations and have meditation or people praying for them afterwards and those who don't have meditation in their life or people praying afterwards. But he said this, and he wrote me a note on the side and said, actually, he said, in my home library, I have a whole section on Meister Eckhart. But he said, whether our species has a future on Earth does not depend on the development of more gee whiz technologies. I feel I had to speak this in Silicon Valley. You see. But on whether we are willing to move into the psycho-spiritual dimension proclaimed by Meister Eckhart and elucidated by Matthew Fox in this book. So this is my new book, Meister Eckhart, A Mystic Warrior for Our Time. But it's not that there's competition here between gee whiz technologies and spirituality. But gee whiz technologies are not going to save the world. Rabbi Heschel said, the human race will not be saved by more information, but more appreciation. Appreciation. Where did that come from? Well, speaking autobiographically, I'll tell you a quick story. When I was 12 years old, I got polio. And my father had been football coach at the University of Wisconsin. I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin. My two older brothers had been all-state football. And I just presumed, well, I was going to be a football player. That's what boys become or something. Then I lost my legs. And they couldn't tell me if I'd ever walk again. And so for a year, I was kind of in this suspended state. I didn't worry about it, though. A friend of mine had died of polio the year before. Many years later, my mother told me that I taught my father moral courage. She said, when you had polio, he was really afraid. See, his father had polio and was subject to a wheelchair the rest of his life. But she said, you weren't afraid. And he used to admire physical courage. But when you went through what you went through, and weren't all that worried about it, it really flipped them. And he shifted and became a different kind of person. But after about a year, I did get my legs back. And I remember saying to the universe, I'll never take my legs for granted again. And I think that's a very mystical statement, not to take for granted. And that's the basis of appreciation. Meditating on breath. I think it's a great thing not to take breath for granted. If you've ever been present for the birth of a baby, you know what a sacred thing the first breath is. And if you've been present for the passing of a person, you know what a holy thing that last breath is. Why is it between the first and the last, we're tempted to take everyone for granted? That's the wisdom of meditation, isn't it? Not to take the obvious for granted, whether it's legs or whether it's breath, whether it's our eyes, whether it's our minds, whether it's our capacity for joy, for love, for truth. It seems to me what you could almost say that the whole spiritual journey is a journey in appreciation. Meister Eckhart said, if the only prayer you say in your whole life is thank you, that would suffice. So he and Rabbi Heschel are on the same page. How deep is our gratitude? And how can these new gee whiz technologies contribute to arousing gratitude? Because I think that's what our species needs to survive. We need to rediscover what a rare gift and invitation it is to be here. And how rare being is. I always tell my students, the most important meditation you do in your whole life is on the empty chair. Put into this empty chair all your brothers and sisters that were never born and will never be born. Until you do that meditation, you don't realize what a marvel, that is a miracle it is, that you're here. With your story and your DNA and your eyes and your mind and your heart. That's part of appreciation. Now I think, you know, for 40, 45 years, our species has kind of been honoring this icon taken by astronauts of the Earth. And you know what I'm talking about, the planet Earth. But there's a new icon that's just been born, thanks to technology. And this is the picture taken recently by the satellite that we sent out, I think, 12 years ago from the edge of the solar system. Now, if you haven't seen this, look it up. It's on the internet everywhere. And it's a picture taken as this satellite was leaving the solar system, looking back home on Earth. And what you see, of course, there are a lot of sparks. These stand for stars and so forth. But the scientists had to put an arrow on this one dot, say, Earth. That's the new icon. Everyone has to be meditating on that. Because it's obvious, we've been meditating for 44 years on the sacredness of Earth, and, you know, we haven't become much more peaceful that I know of. And the truth is also true. The great inventions of Silicon Valley have not yet rendered us more peaceful. But I think that's what we have to shift icons. We don't want to forget the close-up of Mother Earth. But this one, what do I so love about this one? It puts things in perspective. And even that, it's a tiny perspective. The edge of the solar system is nothing compared to the edge of the galaxy, and then the edge of all the other galaxies. But to find some context, some perspective for who we are and where we are and how incredibly gratuitous is our existence, and fragile and special. Now, it's true, we're finding other planets that may have life in them, and all that's great. But this is ours, and there's no doubt there's life here. There's doubt about whether there's intelligence on this planet, but there is life. So, I think this is what's calling us, whether we be Buddhist or Hindu or Christian or Jewish or Muslim or goddess or indigenous or atheist. This is our home, and it's a dot. And it's a precious dot. And how in love with it are we? There's a classical sin called acedia, A-C-E-D-I-A. It's been mistranslated as sloth. Thomas Aquinas in 13th century defines it as the lack of energy to begin new things. It's really a very broad category. We would use a language today, and it's so prevalent we've invented a new word, couch potatoitis. That's what ACD is. It's couch potatoitis. It's passivity. It's the lack of energy to begin new things. And we're all tempted by it. And especially in our culture where you're invited to become a couch potato. To be passive before more basketball games, football games, advertisements, and all the other torrents of goodies that we are offered 24/7 on television and everywhere else. So we have to make an effort. Now, what's the opposite of acedia? What's the medicine for acedia? Aquinas says zeal comes. Zeal is the opposite of acedia. Acedia is lack of energy. Zeal is energy. Zeal comes from an intense experience of the beauty of things. There is the medicine. In other words, it's about falling in love. We have to fall in love all over again with the earth. Now that we know our place and our uniqueness in this solar system, to fall in love with the earth from many angles. If we were in love with the earth, we wouldn't be tolerating what we're doing to the earth. We wouldn't be tolerating our spending $40,000 a second on weapons. That's where I think that new icon could help so much. It puts things in perspective. We're just a dot. Who the hell cares who wins the next war? What we should be caring about is no war. Moving beyond the reptilian brain as the dominant power on the planet. That we keep feeding. We're feeding it with our taxes. We're feeding it with our political shibboleths. We're feeding it with our projections. We're feeding it because we're not in touch with our deeper selves. My own growing up, I grew up in Wisconsin, as I said, and some things that were very important for me were the seasons. That was before climate change. There were real winters in Wisconsin. I remember one winter, we had to crawl out windows on the second floor of the house because the snow was so high. And the change of seasons was very stark in Wisconsin. In California, it's quite subtle in comparison. But Madison has lots of lakes, and being outdoors was so marvelous in each of the seasons. And Madison being a capital city, so there was the political dimension that was pretty viable. And, of course, it's a university town like Berkeley. It's the University of Wisconsin there. So there was that intellectual dimension. And it was just a beautiful place to grow up. And also, the Native American tradition is very strong still in Wisconsin. I had dreams, Native American dreams, the time I was very little. The land, the spirit of the Native people is still very alive in the land in Wisconsin. At least it was when I was growing up. So all that meant a lot to me. And then this experience when I was 12, I got my legs back and learned something about not taking for granted. I went to public high school, and my best friends were Jewish or agnostic or Protestant, so we had all these great philosophical debates about life. And I'd go to my parish priest, who was a Dominican, and get kind of ammunition. So he had me reading G.K. Chesterton and Thomas Aquinas, and the intellectual side of faith meant a lot to me as I was growing up. And when I was a senior, I attended a retreat in the Dominican, what I call a monastery, I guess, in Dubuque, Iowa, where young Dominicans were being trained. And I was very moved by it. I was moved by three things. One was the sense of community. I was from a family of seven kids, and I liked the idea of having a lot of people around me. At least I used to, not in our time. And the other was the intellectual side, that it mattered to me that the Dominicans were taught that study is a prayer. If you bring your heart to it, it's a prayer. And that meant a lot to me, the search for truth. And a third dimension was the aesthetic of it, because they would pray chanting. They did a lot of meditation and silence, but they also chanted a lot, the Psalms, which is the wisdom literature of Israel. And I was very moved by the aesthetic of it. It was very moving to me. So I said, well, I'll give this life a shot. And so I joined the Dominicans a couple years after high school. And I'll always be grateful to them, because they had a very rich and balanced tradition. And not only Thomas Aquinas, but Meister Eckhart. Although we never once heard Meister Eckhart's name in all my 13 years of training. I had to discover Eckhart through a Hindu, Kumaraswamy. Yeah. Many years later, I was reading Kumaraswamy's book on nature and art. And there's a whole chapter on Eckhart. And Kumaraswamy says, reading Eckhart is like reading the Upanishads. And so that kind of set me going on Eckhart. That plus, I had an operation that summer. I was in a serious car accident. And Eckhart came to me during the operation. We went walking together on the beach. Didn't talk. It was the most transcendent dream of my life, really. So I knew after that Eckhart and I had something going, some kind of destiny. He was condemned, by the way, by the Pope in the 14th century. So, not necessarily a bad reference. But during my training, I was we did a lot of things by osmosis, for example, vegetarianism or fasting and celibacy and all this. But they didn't talk about this stuff very much. And so I was, I told my superiors in the Dominicans that I was going through my training, I said, my generation is going to be less interested in religion and more interested in spirituality. But there's no one really teaching spirituality here. It's kind of by osmosis. So why don't you send someone on to get a degree in spirituality? And I'm here if you want to send me. Well, they came to me a couple years later and said, hey, good news. You can go to Europe and get a doctorate in spirituality. I said, good, where do I go? Go to Spain. Spain? No, we don't need more 16th century Spanish spirituality. I said, but say, go to Rome. Rome, I said, for spirituality? You must be kidding. Well, wise guy, they said, where do you go? I said, I don't know, but I'll write Thomas Merton and ask him. Thomas Merton was a very good Catholic monk who became a good friend of Thich Nhat Hanh toward the end of his life. And make long story short, he wrote me, my Dominicans thought I was crazy writing Merton. 4 days later, I got a full-page letter from Merton saying, go to Paris, Institut Catholique in Paris. And I brought this to the Dominicans. They said, Paris? They said, we've never sent anyone to France who came home again. Right? But I said, but Merton says, no, you can't go. But Merton says, but then finally I said, okay, go. Of course, when I did come home, they regretted it. years later. Anyway, it was in Paris that I met a mentor. I had my mentor, Père Chenu, C-H-E-N-U, a wonderful, wonderful man, Dominican, 75 years old when I knew him, and when I had him in class. He is the father of the grandfather of liberation theology. Gustavo Gutierrez, who wrote the first book on liberation theology, studied with Chenu. And Shmuel's the one who named the creation spiritual tradition for me. And it was like scales coming off my eyes. Because in my training, I had sensed that there was this conflict between body and spirit, matter and spirit, that was kind of hidden and unspoken in a lot of the lessons I was being given. And that was not my experience in my home, bringing or in my experience of growing up close to nature and of my interest in science too. So I just didn't buy into that dualism. But when Shanu explained that that tradition, the dualistic tradition from Plato by way of Augustine, and then the idea of original sin, which Jesus never heard of, but comes from Augustine, the 4th century AD. I mean, all that added up. Oh, that's one thing. But this creation tradition that Shnu is talking about is Jewish, and it goes way, way back. And of course, later I found how deeply rooted it is in the indigenous people of this land, and not just this land, but in Australia and Africa too. So that was part of my awakening. When I returned in the early 70s, there was, of course, the eco movement was starting, the gay movement was starting, and, of course, the women's movement was really coming along. And, of course, the anti-war movement of the 60s, I was certainly involved in that. Even in Paris, we were marching. And, by the way, here's one story about Shnu. I was there in 1968. Well, I was there 67 and 70, but I was Shnu in class in 68, in the spring of 68. When the students in Paris brought down de Gaulle's government. They were so committed to a change in education and culture. And everything in Paris was closed down practically, all the other schools, but ours was still going. And Shanu in class one day, we were studying 12th century spirituality, and I remember at the end he shut his book, and he was 75 years old at the time. He said, well, now there's a revolution going on, so don't come back next class. Join the revolution. Come back in 2 weeks and tell me what you've contributed. And again, the guy was 75. At that very moment, in a town called Tübingen, Germany, where the students were also rioting, they broke into a theology faculty meeting to vent. And all the faculty stayed to hear the venting of the students, except one. This professor stood up, walked out of the room, and the next time people saw him, he was an arch conservative. And his name was Joseph Ratzinger, who became Cardinal Ratzinger, who brought the Inquisition back under Pope John Paul II, and then became Benedict XVI. And he was like 42 years old. My mentor at 75 was saying, join the revolution. Ratzinger freaked out at 42 and became literally an inquisitor the rest of his life. So I was very blessed. I escaped that fate. I didn't escape Ratzinger. He came after me, but it took him 12 years to expel me. So, when Ratzinger made himself Pope about 7 or 8 years ago, at that time I was invited to do some lectures on Pentecost in Pentecost season in Germany, at a healing center in Germany. Because Pentecost is a real big feast in Europe, especially Germany, like schools, banks closed down, all that stuff. And Pentecost is, of course, the celebrations of the Holy Spirit coming over the apostles at the beginning when they were all afraid, and it turned them into warriors and all this good stuff. But sometimes it's talked about as the birthday of the church. So when Pentecost rolled around and Ratzinger was the new pope, and I was invited to Germany to speak, I was not feeling good about that. I was wrestling, and I said, I think I should cancel, because I knew Ratzinger after fighting him for 12 years, and I knew that the future of this particular church body was not going to be pretty. And so what do? I said, well, I really shouldn't cancel because these people have promoted and they're expecting me and all the rest. What do? So when I went to bed and I asked for a dream. And I got a dream. And the dream reminded me that this pope is the first German pope in 1,000 years or something. And there was another German named Luther who did something about rattling cages when the church was corrupt. So I got up at 3 in the morning and said, now Luther had 95 theses. I bet I have about 25 inside of me. And I sat down in a rocking chair. By the time the sun rose at 6, I had 95 theses. And I was exhausted and went back to sleep, back to bed, and got up and read them over and said, hey, these aren't bad. I can live with these. So now I had a good reason for going to Germany, not just to do the healing talks, but to go to Wittenberg and pound my theses on the door there, which I did. And a few years ago, when the Italians started translating my work for the first time, I and the publisher invited me out there to do some book signing and media stuff. I said, well, yes, but I felt I had to do something else also. And that was just 3 years ago. And then I said, oh, yeah, I'll translate the theses into Italian. And now where will I pound them? Well, I can't pound them in the Vatican because I'd be arrested in 10 seconds. And I know where I'll pound them. I pound them at the 4th century Basilica where Cardinal Law was promoted. Cardinal Law was the notorious Archbishop of Boston who passed around priests who were pedophiles. One guy abused 150 boys. And instead of ending his career, he would pass them from parish to parish. So, and then when the Attorney General of Boston was coming after Cardinal Law with the subpoena and all the rest, he escaped to Rome, and Rome promoted him, gave him this 4th century basilica. So I went to his basilica at 10 a.m. on a Sunday morning and pounded the theses there in Italian and spoke to the media there. And that was kind of interesting because there were some Vatican police back there who actually beat up my friend who was taking a flip camera of the whole event. And so it taught me more about the dark side of religion. And but that night I was on a big TV program and there were like 2,000 young people live. It was a live thing. And the fellow asked me, what were you doing this morning at that church? And so I just said, and I said, you know, we got to stand up to immorality wherever it is. You know, we can't eat couch potatoes. And the whole group broke out into applause and everything. It's really very, very touching to see that the Italians get it too. And I'll tell you, that morning in front of the church, a 40-year-old Italian came up to me and he said to me, in kind of broken English, he said, I used to call myself a Catholic. Now I just call myself a Christian. And I thought it was very telling that even in Rome, under the Pope's nose, there's this thing going on. And there is. It turns out that my book, Original Blessing, was the first book they translated. Became a bestseller in Italy. And so now they're doing a ton more of my books. And so there's something really stirring. And this is what we have to do. We have to stir up our capacity for spirituality. And we have to move beyond religion. And all of our traditions have to critique themselves. Because I am a Westerner, because I come from a Christian tradition, and I choose to be a Christian. It's my job to critique my roots. But Hindus have to critique their roots, and Buddhists theirs, and Jews theirs. We can't blithely go along as if things are just great, and that everything from the past is pertinent today. As I say, we can't travel with basilicas on our back. We have to travel with backpacks. We all have to lighten our spiritual loads. And we have to learn from one another. We have to, and it's such a blessing today to be exposed to so many forms of meditation, for example, so many forms of ritual. Now, it was in Australia about 8 or 10 years ago, and I was lecturing at a college, that a young man, about 22, when I finished, he asked this question. He said, does Christian spirituality have a strategy for social transformation? It's a wonderful question. And it just kind of, it came at a really good time for me. And it's in that context that I articulated that if we could reinvent worship and ritual, if we could reinvent education and reinvent work, we would have a nonviolent revolution. So in many ways, that's been my work, because for over 30 years, I have designed and practiced an alternative educational model that really works. It includes right and left brain, body, all the chakras. And I've seen so many conversions happen. I'll just give you one or two stories. Here's one story. In our doctoral program a few years ago, our doctoral ministry program in Oakland, a fellow came in who's been teaching engineering for 27 years at the University of Colorado. And he said to me, I'm burned out by academia. I'm burned out by engineering. I don't know what's next. 2 weeks later, he came to me and he said, I got my soul back. He went back to Boulder. He started Engineers Without Borders, which now has 14,000 members. And they're doing all the miracles that engineers can do. And they're sending people to Haiti and to the Amazon and Africa and every place, Afghanistan, help people to create solar-generated irrigation systems and all these other miracles that need doing. He has a conference every year. Last year it was like 1,000 people came from 95 countries, many with their own inventions for purifying water and all these basic things that our species needs. And he told me, I ran into him a few months ago, it was all from those 2 weeks in your program. He got a soul back. Well, I think a lot of people need to get the soul back after going through academia. I've been in academia for over 40 years, and I've been in religion for at least that long. And both of them need a lot of cleaning up. And when I left my university a few years ago, I kind of sat down, what's next? And what came to me was, well, if you believe so much in this pedagogy for adults, why don't you apply it to where it's really needed in the inner city? You know, 65% of black boys are not graduating from high school today in America, 65%. Is that because they're dumb or because our definition of education is dumb? We're boring them. That's why they're dropping out. So I did. I boiled the pedagogy down and did this program, which is called Yell Awe. Yell Awe. And I wrote a book on education called the Awe Project, Ancestral Wisdom Education. Awe stands for that, but it also stands for awe. Awe is the first breath of mysticism. It is our awakening, what Rabbi Heschel calls radical amazement. With awe, everything's possible. Without it, well, Heschel says, forfeit your sense of awe and the universe becomes a marketplace for you. The idols of consumer capitalism take over if you've lost your sense of awe. And that's what I meant earlier by saying the sense of appreciation. Awe awakens reverence and gratitude. So I did a 2-year pilot project with inner city kids in Oakland and in a charter school that specialized in kids who are dropping out. And they said at the end, 100% of them said they want to stay in school now. And why? Because they experienced the joy of learning. The joy of learning. And what's the key to joy of learning? Creativity. We had them making movies. And we had them doing a lot of other creative projects. One day, a black kid, 18, a senior, turned to me in class and said, this is the first time in 4 years of high school that anyone's asked me to express myself creatively. First time in 4 years of high school. And we're so busy giving exams and calling that education that we've forgotten what learning is. Learning is a joy. It's a spiritual activity. Some of the highest moments of my life have been discovering truth through learning. It's a built-in ecstasy. As I say, our minds are as eager for truth as our stomachs are for good food. We're here to salivate over truth. And we've set up a whole system that has divorced the joy of learning from this racket called education. And we can do better, and we have to do better, because education is the funnel through which we pass so many of our workers. We're not going to clean up any of our professions without also cleaning up education itself. But we have so much going for us again. Einstein has that incredible passage where he says that we have been given two gifts, the sacred gift of intuition and the gift of rationality. Rationality needs to serve intuition. But he said, we live in a culture that honors rationality and has forgotten the sacred gift. Now, for me, the word intuition is a synonym for mysticism, our right brains. And it's the dawning of creativity. That has to get much more important in our schools and in our looking at life. Because the only way we humans, the one thing we humans have going for us is our creativity. I wrote a book a few years ago on creativity. I begin it with this fact. Anthropologists, when they're looking for our ancestors, they look for bipeds and artifacts next to the bipeds. So the working definition of a human being for anthropologists is a biped who makes things. There you are. A creative biped. If that's who we are, why isn't creativity front and center from preschool and kindergarten through professional school? Well, one reason it's not is that our anal retentive bean counters have taken over. And, of course, we have to balance our books eventually or once in a while and all that good stuff. But the real meaning of what it means to be a human being has been lost in the process. Because we've made idols of numbers. So, I know I was supposed to talk about 30 minutes, and is this about it? I haven't been watching the time. I'm going to open up for some discussion. Sure, yeah. Okay, well, let's see if I have anything to wind up with. It's just that we're blessed to be living at this time. This is such a critical time, and it's such an opportunity. And Thomas Berry says the great movements of history happened in the darkest times. He talks about the 3rd century in China when the Han Dynasty ran out of steam. And that is precisely when Buddhism stepped into the void and created a whole new culture that kept the Chinese people alive and healthy and together for well over 1,000 years, 1,500 years, 1,700 years. And he talks about the Middle Ages in the West. And that happened too. And it was the goddess, it was the return of the divine feminine in the 12th century that reinvented education. The university movement was born in the 12th century. Of course, it came from Islam. But what the university first meant was a place to go to find your place in the universe. Not to find your place in a man-made work world, but in the universe. This is why this icon that we can all look at together today is so important. It can reinvent education too. And of course, bringing the divine feminine back is so important today for men and for women and for the earth. And we're fully capable of this, and we're hungry for it, whether we know it or not. So, people sometimes ask me, are you hopeful? Are you optimistic? No. I'm not a fool. But my hope is conditional. If humans can wake up, this awakening circle, if we can wake up to our own silence, to our own depth, to our own creativity, to our own togetherness, no matter how wonderfully different and diverse we are, of course we have a chance. Of course we have a chance. And it's so obvious that we got to get out of our couches and do our best. And for some people that means remaining in the institutions and kicking them and speaking out and being creative And as Jesus said, as subtle as a serpent, as smart as a dove. For others, it means being one foot in and one foot out. And for others, it means launching whole new shoots, whole new forms. Let me say one more word about worship and ritual, because I've been involved for 16 years now in what we call the Cosmic Mass. And this is an effort to bring, well, life to worship. And the life especially of the rave community. Because I sensed 20 years ago that rave was doing, well, like Burning Man is doing. Why do 60,000 people go out in the desert in August for a ritual? It's not rational at all. It's intuitive. Maybe it's counterintuitive. You think you'd go in February, not August, to the desert. Why is it drawing 60,000 people? Because people are starved for ritual. And in our souls, we know how important it is. But there must be other ways to enliven ritual besides just 60,000 people in a desert for a week. And so I've been trying to do that, what we call the Cosmic Mass, and we've had some stunning experiences. We've done over 95 of these over the last 15 years. So I did bring a flyer with me. We're doing one at the end of the month, last Saturday of June. Easy to remember, June 28th, 6 p.m. at Grace Cathedral. We've never done it there before. We're doing one, and the theme is the return of the Divine Feminine. So you're all welcome. And we've always had, last summer we did it for 1,000 people at the Sounds True Conference in the mountains of the Rocky Mountains there in Colorado. And it's so powerful to bring people of many traditions together for a ritual that is both fun, and there's a lot of dance, there's a lot of DJing and VJing, and a lot of good music, but also it's prayer. I'll never forget, we did it once for a body soul conference in San Francisco at a big hotel, like 1,300 people there. And afterwards, four young men came up to me and they said, we go to raves all the time. One of them said, I've been going to raves every weekend for 5 years. I wanted to say, get a life, but I didn't. I bit my tongue. And he was like 19. But he said, what I've been looking for at rave, I found here tonight. I'm looking for prayer, deep prayer, and I'm looking for community. And what you have here that we don't have at rave is a heterogeneous group. You have different generations. In a rave, there's only one generation, you see, represented. So my point is that the shortcut for unleashing our creativity, our joy, and dealing with our grief, which has to be dealt with or there'll be no creativity, the shortcut is ritual or ceremony. And we should keep our eye out for it, and we should be involved in it. So I do want to throw out that invitation for last Saturday of June. This should be fun. Okay, let's open this up to your connection making or questions or comments. Yes.
So thank you, Matthew, for that. I feel like the room is a pond that's been stirred up with a stick, and there's a lot of truth floating around. We have a room full of truth seekers and people who've embodied truth in their own ways, and so I know there will be plenty of questions and reflections. So if you could raise your hand, I will come over with the mic as you have questions. And then somewhere in this beautiful chaos, dinner will also be served, and we'll have a special ceremony around that as well. So if you could raise your hand, I'll come over. Did you see a question?
Yeah, there's so many things.
All right.
Thank you so much for your talk. It's very moving. I'm in, my field is education. I'm in a PhD program, actually. And so I resonate with what you said about academia, and as I'm wanting to work in education that can promote flourishing. So I would love to know more about what you see as the next steps that are needed in education and ways that researchers or academics can get involved and people outside of the who might want to get involved in the education community, just different people, how they can get involved.
Yeah, I think the key is making room for training the right brain as well as the left brain. And the way we did that in our doctor ministry program is we'd have seminars in the morning. So that's left brain. You're reading books, writing papers, discussing ideas. But the day would begin actually with body prayer. So before the seminar, you'd have like 25 minutes of body prayer, circle dancing or chanting, enchanting and so forth. And, you know, from various traditions. The dance is universal peace. Be a good example of that. They draw from many traditions. So then you have 3 hours of the seminar and so forth. And then the afternoon, we have what we call art as meditation. Art as meditation. So that could be clay as meditation, or dance, or painting, or chanting, or maybe Native American ritual. You know, rituals from various traditions and so forth. But that made all the difference. And then by the evening, people were completely turned on because both their brains had been fed and nurtured and nourished. And I think that pedagogy should be borrowed in all colleges and certainly in professional schools. We drew a lot because the theme of our program was work in spirituality, to bring spirituality to your profession. We drew a lot of therapists and social workers and artists and activists, engineers, some doctors, because they all recognized they did not get this in their training. Take, for example, therapists. A lot of therapists listen to people's dreams, listen to people's mystical experiences, but how many are trained in the journey that mysticism is, you know? And so a lot of them came because they realized they had not been trained in this stuff. But, of course, primarily they had to go through it themselves. Mysticism is not done vicariously. So I'm happy to give this pedagogy away. It's worked. We did it over 30 years with adults in master's programs and doctorate programs. I'm actually working now with a very exciting project the school in Europe who about bringing this program alive again together, so we'd have a link, a European and a California base maybe. It's so needed. And I think with that, there's perspective. You're training the heart as well as the head. And you're training all the chakras. So that's how we did it, that in a nutshell. And it's not theory. We did it for 30 years. And we had all kinds of people undergoing these conversions like that engineer did. And it's hard to teach adults because there's so much to unlearn, especially when it comes to education. So it's like falling off a log to bring this to kids. Again, though, I wrote a little book called The Awe Project, which lays out the philosophy of this. You can look that up, yeah.
Matthew, it's a joy to hear you. Thank you. As a Jew, I want to understand something about your Christianity. I'm a student of Reb Zalman, who you know.
Yes, 90th birthday coming up.
And
great man.
He's very sick right now. Yeah. He needs our prayers. But as a follower of Reb Zalman, one of the things I learned as a Jew was how to, at the same time, be very anchored and authentically anchored in our faith and our tradition and still be open to the world. I want to understand how that works for a Christian. You believe that Jesus Christ is the path to salvation. How can you be open to the whole world sharing the path to salvation?
Well, I don't think Jesus Christ is the only path to salvation. I think he's one of many. I think that he incorporates the wisdom and the prophetic tradition of Israel, which is so important. I always remember that Gandhi said, I learned to say no from the West. See, Gandhi learned the no from the prophets of Israel. Hello. I lost my. Maybe I can borrow this. I had a dream several years ago. I was doing a workshop in California, someplace, Malibu, and they put this. Can I just speak? Overnight, and they said, you'll be all alone here, but a group may come in the morning and chant.
Hello, hello.
And sure enough, a group came in, about half a dozen, and chanted in the morning. It was a beautiful way to wake up in the morning. I went back to sleep and had this dream about Jesus and Buddha. And this is what I learned. Buddha, you know, lived to be about 83 or 84. He saw all of life. He was a husband and a father and a prince. Seeker and all that. And he died serenely at about 84. Jesus got himself killed at 30. So what I learned was this. We need the holy patience and serenity of the Buddha, and we need the holy impatience of Jesus. Especially at this critical time. And I say not just Jesus, but the other prophets of Israel. And so, as I said earlier, you know, I draw from the spiritual riches of Judaism and of Native American and of other traditions. In my book, One River, Many Wells, I go through all of them. And certainly, the Upanishads and the Vedas just absolutely blow my mind. In fact, that's what most moved me. It was the freshest to me when I did that book on One River, Many Wells, because that's about the world's spiritual traditions. But I'm always learning. Now, the problem with a lot of Christians is that they have a very narrow understanding of Christ. They think Christ and Jesus are the same thing, and they aren't. The cosmic Christ is the divine image in every being in the universe. It's the light in every being in the universe. So, and you can call it something else. You can call it the Buddha nature. You can call it Shekinah. You can call it photons, because science has now established that every atom in the universe contains photons, which are light waves. And I see Jesus as a light and particle, and I see myself as a particle with a wave. And the wave is that Christ light, or Christ consciousness, or Buddha nature. Again, words never do divinity justice. Eckhart says, God is superessential darkness and has never been given a name and will never be given a name. That's the apophatic divinity. Thich Nhat Hanh is very big on that. Most Buddhists are. You know, we can overdo the God talk. Christians are always overdoing the God talk. And that's why I love Eckhart's prayer when he says, I pray God to rid me of God. That we have to pull back and quit projecting. But to find the Christ within, or the Buddha nature within. And so these few phrases which are in John's Gospel, for example, which did not come from the mouth of the historical Jesus, they came from the early community, that I am the way, for example. Well, that I am is not Jesus talking. He never talked like that. What it means is that once you discover the Buddha nature or the Christ nature or the presence of God in and among things, that is the way. Follow it. And if you see the Buddha on the way, kill him. In other words, don't take it literally. I've learned in life after 73 and a half years, don't take anything important literally. Don't take love or death or spirit or sex. Literally, they're all much bigger than that. They're metaphors. They're metaphors that arouse the soul. And the same is true of the feeble attempts we have to name divinity. Anything less than that is idolatry, I think. And we were warned by your ancestors about that.
Thank you.
Just loved your talk. Loved everything you said.
Thank you.
I kind of it really makes more sense to me, you know, that what you're talking about, not taking things literally, because I think pretty much all the big teachers in the world have spoken in parables, and they've used the language of parables in order to, you know, speak these truths. And one of the problems, like you said, with the Christians is they get that fundamentalist kind of idea, and they take everything just way too literally. My question to you would be, there's been a lot of things said about the whole 2012, you know, December 2012, thing. What is your thought on that? Do you think that was like the gateway for humanity to move, you know, take a big leap forward in the energy level or in their energy evolution? So,
well, I hope December 2012 was. I also hope that June 2014 is. We never get little about that either, you see. You know, I mean, we are given an opportunity every morning the sun rises, and every day and every week and every month and every year. You know, how much longer is it going to take our species to wake up? And because time is running out. So all I can say is that I hope that 2012 was the door. But I don't look back that much. You know, I'm looking forward, and I'm asking, you know, let's get practical. What can we do to awaken and to get people out of our couches and get over denial? You know, I mean, to think that a whole political party in America is committed to the denial of climate warming, even as they sweat themselves to death in Washington, is beyond imagination. Eckhart says, God is the denial of denial. And I just love that. Because it means when we can let go of denial, God can flow again. But I think that we're in a lot of denial. We're in denial about how perverted our economic system is. And, I mean, this whole thing about Wall Street raping Main Street, it happened. It's still happening. And they've made off like bandits. Now, are we capable of inventing an economic system that works for everybody? And by everybody, I don't mean just the two-legged ones, but the forests, the tree people, the oceans, the fishes, the four-legged ones. Yes, we're capable of that. And great people like David Corton in our time have been working on that. For me, one of the biggest scandals of the Obama administration is that they've not invited someone like David Corton to whisper in the ear of a Treasury Secretary or something, you know. And I'm at this time I'm afraid of Hillary Clinton too. That they're not thinking; they're just putting Band-Aids on a system that is not sustainable. And we're in denial about how feeble and dangerous and destructive consumer capitalism is to the soul as well as to the planet. And we can do better than that. And people like David Corton are showing the way. So, you know, my understanding of Hinduism is that really all sin is about ignorance. Well, people can choose ignorance. Another word for that is denial. Let's wallow in our ignorance. Let's go shopping. So, you know, we've got to start rattling the cages and beating the drums. And I think this is part of what the Occupy movement did for us. It started to wake people up around these topics. And right in Wall Street's face. Of course, it's morphing into something else. But the values are there. And I just think that as a species, we're not on a sustainable path. And if we really want people to imitate our economic system, all the studies show we'd need 5 more planets for everyone to live our lifestyles. So that doesn't seem real practical at this time either. So let's get moving. Yes?
So we're actually, we have a signal from the angels in the kitchen that dinner is ready to be served. And the way this will work is, for those of you who haven't been here for a guest speaker event before, we'll all stay seated. Plates will be handed out from the back. And as you receive a plate, just hand it forward. And miracle of miracles, very soon everyone will have a plate. And water will be handed out as well. And we'll take a moment of collective gratitude for the meal that we're going to share and the company that we're sharing it in. And after that, we will continue through our meal with the Q&A, if Matthew is all right with that. And I think it'll improve it. And we do have one request. The talk is being live streamed, so we do have online presence as well. And so as we're eating, if we can be a little mindful of the noise that our spoons and forks make on the plate, that would be showing a lot of compassion to the people who aren't here in the room. And I want to say thank you, not just for being here, but for your life and what you're choosing to do with it. One of the open questions I still grapple with is the intersection of the right brain and the left brain. And what I've found in my personal experience is when I think too much, my creativity shuts down. And I'm trying to figure out how that relates to intellect and intuition, because for me, creativity is intuition. And so I'm still, it's an open question for me, and I was curious to know what, if you could speak a little bit more about that.
So the question is kind of, how do we bring our right and left brains together? Is that kind of what you're...
Yeah, how do you...
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first is being aware. You know, being aware that we, like Einstein said, we have these two powers. The intuition and their intellect, and they're both wonderful. They're both gifts. But I look on it as a marriage. You know, this is the way I understand the sixth chakra. The sixth chakra, to me, is the marriage of the left and right brain. And like any marriage, you know, they're apart at times. They need their own space. But they also get together. And When I'm in a creative state, Eckhart writes about this. He takes a psalm that says something like the rushing river. The spirit is a rushing river, and the image that comes to me is kind of like being on one of these river rafts without an oar. You're just going along for the ride, but it's very powerful, and you lose all sense of time. And you yield to spirit, the spirit of creativity. And that doesn't, you don't throw intellect overboard. You know, intellect is part of what you're gathering. To me, creativity is about gathering. And then, like, I find that if, you know, I'm studying something and then I live with it for a while, and then it wants to find an expression, a creative expression. So, I don't know, maybe I'm just lucky, but I find it's just very natural. Now, in our pedagogy, as I said, we kind of set it up. It's pretty clear. Morning is for the left brain, so to speak. Afternoon is for the right brain. And then we actually have at the end of the day something we call process seminar, where we sit in small groups and discuss what we went through that day or what we learned. So that's kind of a coming together, the telling of the story. And that might be kind of a clue too, to kind of tell the story. How is your brain, your left brain work, bringing new ideas and insight and fact checking? our more intuitive brain. But again, I think the body integrates all of this too. For example, sports or yoga, other body practices. there's an intelligence to playing sport well. It's like a chess game, as well as intuition and physicality and all the rest. And I think that there's something about our bodies that yearns to make things whole. And again, if we're in a culture that defines truth as clear and distinct ideas, which is how Descartes did it 300-400 years ago, then we're only thinking from the neck up. And we're the right brain does not get fed by that. The right brain, after all, runs our hearts, which are on the left side of our bodies. So, and heart has many meanings, but I just think if we're conscious of all of how each chakra carries its own truth, and somehow we'll make room for it there. So, I mean, I think, like I say, I think your question is 90% of the answer that you're looking how to bring these together. Eckhart has an amazing passage when he's talking about compassion, and he says, obviously, compassion is a passion, but you must use what we would call left brain as well. He says you must use your reason too. So it's true, of course, that you don't want your compassion to be just raw feeling and emotion. You've got to strategize. What is the best use of this moral outrage that I am in touch with? How do I steer this moral outrage, this fire, into something effective? Like Gandhi, he made a march to the sea. King, he filled the jails. They had a strategy. But what urged them was their intuition about injustice, the kick in the gut in the third chakra. So I think that's a good example where the left brain is really needed. Strategy is important. And I don't think our right brain gives us strategy so much as direction. And Einstein says it gives us values. He says, do not overtrust the intellect. The intellect does not give you values. It gives you methods. See, that's strategy again. But he says values come from intuition and feeling, which are the same thing. Not emotion, but feeling. That's what Einstein says. And I think he's very right. And that's why we need the mystics to give us direction. And to me, the mystic is everyone in this room. You have to listen to your own mystic self give it one's attention and respect.
We have a question way back here.
Matthew, thank you very much for your insights tonight and your insights and all your work for your career. You talked tonight about gratitude, a lot about gratitude. That's what I picked up on. And I'm wondering if you would care to comment on what role you think forgiveness plays. Maybe with some examples of how you've dealt with forgiveness in your life, and maybe a way you've seen forgiveness really change somebody else. Thank you.
I name the spiritual journey in the creation tradition as the via positiva, which is awe, wonder, joy. The via negativa, which is silence and suffering, letting go. The via creativa, which is creativity. And finally, the via transformativa, the path of compassion and justice and healing and celebration. So I see your question, pardon me, as being about the via negativa. Thank you. It's about suffering and letting go, forgiveness. And so that's an important part of the journey for sure. I also think it's about grief. And I alluded just briefly to grief earlier, but I want to say a few words about grief because I think that I believe, you know, you've heard of the dark night of the soul. I think we are in the dark night of our species today. I think our whole species is in a collective dark night. And in the dark night, we don't know how things are going to end. We just know it's dark. And but the mystics teach us that the dark night has something to teach us you don't learn anyplace else. It's a very special school to attend. And I believe today that many of us, all of us, are walking around the planet with a lot of grief in our hearts. Because we know consciously and unconsciously, especially the young ones, because they're less, they're more vulnerable and less protected by letters after their name and all the rest, that we know that the planet is a hospital. And that things are winding down. And obviously, species are disappearing at the greatest rate of in the last 60 million years. And of course, global warming and climate change is happening. And seas are rising. And so forth. So, there's a lot to grieve. Say nothing of just the ordinary things of loss of loved ones or loss of a relationship and other, or disease or bad health or something like that. I do not believe the religions of the world are doing a good job in dealing with grief today. I've been developing some grief ceremonies, rituals, for that reason. And including our Cosmic Mass always has a grief ritual. And you see, forgiving is one dimension to grief. That's why I'm talking about this in light of your question. And two summers ago, Sounds True invited me to lead a grief ceremony for 800 people at their annual conference. And it was extremely powerful and well-received. Again, people of many traditions and no tradition. One fellow came up to me afterwards and said, he said, I've been seeing a psychiatrist for 21 years. I'm going to fire her on Monday. All I really needed was this grief ceremony. We all need grieving today, and we have to be more conscious of it. Because if we don't deal with grief, there's this rock, a boulder in our hearts, that blocks our creativity. And I think it has a lot to do with the denial that we're in, that I was talking about earlier. We're in denial because we're afraid that we don't have the goods to make a difference, to shift our ways. But one reason where we don't feel we have the goods, we're disempowered, is that grief is blocking our creativity. So I see forgiveness really as part of grieving, part of letting go. But I think it's very important not to be, if you will, altruistic about forgiveness. To me, you forgive someone or a circumstance because that's the only way to be free yourself. And I think that we make a mistake if we think, oh, we're going to do this as some kind of act of altruism. It's an act of self-love, really. But all love begins with self-love. You don't have to apologize for that. As Jesus said, you love others as you love yourself. If we haven't learned to love ourselves and forgive ourselves and to grieve our mistakes, we're not in a position to forgive others. So, obviously, forgiveness is very important. And when you hear stories of forgiveness, well, of course, a Nelson Mandela comes to mind, of course. I met a woman a few years ago from Los Angeles. She's an artist. And she told me this story. Her 17-year-old son was murdered in Los Angeles. And they found the young man who killed him, who was like 19 or so, a couple years older. They tried him, convicted him, put him in jail. And she went to visit him in jail. And then she went again. And then she went again. And they became fast friends. And he had not had a mother in his life and so forth. So, I mean, I just find that, I have goosebumps just sharing that story with you. The capacity of our species for forgiveness is quite untapped. But it's amazing when you hear a story like that. And, of course, she found meaning in her whole own son's murder by befriending his murderer. And without forgiveness, of course, you have revenge upon revenge upon revenge. And you have war, and you have the reptilian brain running things. That's one of the things that I think, one way to talk about meditation in scientific terms is to say that meditation is the way you domesticate your reptilian brain. Nice crocodile. And why do I know that? Why am I so sure of that? Because reptiles are not good at bonding, but they're great at lying alone in the sun. Solitude. That's what meditation is. Solitude. Being alone with your deepest self. The word monk comes from the word monos, meaning solitude. So crocodiles are monks. So the way you're going to befriend your crocodile brain is through meditation. And why is that so important? Because then your mammal brain, which is half as old as the reptilian brain, can emerge more fully. And every spiritual teacher I've ever met, east, west, north, south, talks about compassion. Compassion in both Hebrew and Arabic comes from the word for womb. Womb people bring compassion, kinship, family, and all the rest to the planet. And so for compassion to flourish, we have to deal with the reptilian brain. And that has to do with that's what meditation, I think, really helps us with. And then, of course, our third and most recent brain, the cognitive, creative, intellectual brain, should couple itself less to the reptilian brain and more to the mammal brain. Then we get creative and create real strategies of how to get over denial and how to get through the energy crisis and all the other issues that are facing us. So forgiveness, I see, as a very important path along the way. But we shouldn't forget that in many ways it begins with forgiving oneself and coming to grips with our capacity both for criticizing, self-criticism, but also for appreciation. And we're back to that word again.
I know there are many more questions in the room, but first I have one quick announcement and then a request. As you finish your meal, please stay seated. We'll collect the plates at the end, so no need to get up at this point to keep the focus on what's happening here. And the other request is we will try and get to as many questions as possible, but if anyone has a reflection at this point, it would be a wonderful opportunity to allow Matthew to have more than a bite of his food. So, are there any reflections in the group?
By the way, does reflection mean that I could comment as well, right? It's like not just, okay, all right. And during your talk, that I was wondering about something, about systematic beliefs. That, for example, that I have heard many times that meditations are good and good for people, but that is another form of belief system. That we believe that through meditations, we can get somehow more insights, more something and more something. So it's kind of like a trading game or like a commodity. So in a way, that's the same thing goes that when you talk about criticizing as a Christian, as a Jew, as a monk. So basically that is it's kind of like criticizing something that is already, how can I say, corrupted? Probably not, that's not the right word, but similar to that, like you see that there is something that doesn't make sense for you, and then you just change it. And then you mentioned a lot about the use of traditional rituals. And I saw this as another form of, because rituals, the rituals that you have been talking about from the Native Americans or from other ancient rituals, they have been developed long before. And it seems to me that if we cannot just keep developing those rituals into, like, based on, because we know much more than before, I mean, in terms of information or something, that, but I haven't really feel that we are trying to developing something, like something new, something out of extraordinary. And so I have a question, like, you know, how can we get out, for example? What do you think we can get out of this trap? Because it seems, yeah, just, we just keep going in, following somebody else's steps all the time. Like meditations, belief system, communism, even gift economy, we just follow it because it seems like it makes sense. But somehow, there might be something there for each one of us, like something individually, something that can strive. Not within a, like, not systematic for everybody, but unique for everybody, for everyone.
Well, my experience with ceremony and ritual is that it is unique for everyone, and yet there's also a communal participation there as well. And that's where its power lies. Even our meditating here for an hour, being in silence together, is different from being in silence alone. And both are useful and powerful, but I think there's a special energy. The same with the grieving. When we do grieving, a number of times people have come up to me after our Cosmic Mass and said, "Well, I really liked it, I like this, I like that, but what was most important to me was the grieving." A woman said, "I grieve alone in my bedroom. No one's ever asked me to grieve in a group before." So I think healthy ceremony and ritual always allows the individuality along with the communality. And it's not just a communality with the living. Our ancestors need to be invited in the room too. And the angels, the spirits, they're very eager to pray with us, especially today. I had the privilege a month or two ago to invite Laura Byrne out here to the West Coast. Laura Byrne is a peasant Irish woman, 60 years old, illiterate, who from her first memory as a child, 2 years old, was seeing her parents and their guardian angels behind them. She's seen angels her whole life and still sees them. And forget what story I was going to say about Laura now. Let's see, what was I talking about? Well, about ritual.
Today's a good day to pray.
It's a good day to pray. Gosh, I don't remember exactly. I was going to tell a story that she told, but I can't remember now. What?
Solitude.
A solitude? Oh no, I was talking about angels. Yeah, that. She talked. I interviewed her at Grace Cathedral because she doesn't like to give talks. She likes to be interviewed. So, and she said there are a lot of unemployed angels today. Yeah, I said unemployed angels. I said I know a lot of unemployed human beings, and it's a real issue. But don't tell me we also have to start employing the angels. She said, "Oh yeah." She said, "At this time, God is pouring angels on the planet to help us. We need so much help." And she said, "Not enough people are asking the angels for help, so they're unemployed. They're wandering around looking for work." So, think about that when you go to bed tonight. Ask for an angel to give you a dream. Yeah, I don't know if I really addressed what you were talking about, but
there's an angel.
There's an angel. Oh, yeah. You're an angel in disguise. Yes.
We have one question
right
here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Really love your talk and what your life is doing. So as someone who's consciously spiritual and intuitive in a tech corporation, and it's taken a while to get back into that, what's the best thing for some of us to do to help shift the world? I share your concerns about what's happening now with humanity.
Well, of course, number one, I think, is being true to your own complete vision, to the whole, to your spiritual life. One of our graduates decided that she was trying to get the corporate world more spiritual, so she decided to go to law offices and get lawyers to build altars in their law firms. And she's kind of a convincing person. She's very big and strong and tough, and it's quite amazing the story she has to tell. That just bringing an altar into one's office, and if you can do this with lawyers, you can do it in other levels of corporate life as well, I think. But what is an altar? You see, it's a centering device, a focusing device. And, of course, what are you really centering with? Well, it's psyche and cosmos. So this is really at the heart. And Black Elk talks about this, and so do the Upanishads, that in the center of the heart is the universe itself. So if we can bring psyche and cosmos together, even at work, and especially at work, then, of course, what follows next is behavior and values. So what are the values that flow from some recognition of the context in which we're doing law or business or industry and so forth. Or as I wrote about in my book, The Redimensional Work, that the first question we have to ask about work is, where is the joy? What joy are you finding in your work? And what joy are you bringing to others because of your work? That is when work gets spiritual. And those are really important questions. And then another question is, and what relief of suffering are you bringing because of your work? What relief of suffering is this corporation involved in? Or is it creating suffering by whipping up desire, for example, for something that humans don't really need and can't afford at this time in history, etc.? So, I think, again, those are the via positiva question and the via negativa question. What joy are we unleashing because of our work together? And also, what suffering are we relieving because of our work together? And we should be battling those questions around, debating those questions where we live and work. Are we bringing suffering to the planet? Are we bringing harm? Or are we relieving it? And how can we relieve it better and more effectively? How can we bring more joy?
we'll wait for the mic to be passed. If there are questions in order.
We'll go in.
Okay. It's such a treat to listen to you. Thank you so much. You clearly embody the wisdom that's radiating and filling our hearts. One thing that I want to hear from you is actually Pavi, in her introduction, mentioned St. Francis of Assisi. So if you could tell us the story of St. Francis of Assisi, I think it would be a real joy to hear it from you. And the second thing I want you to share, if you're comfortable sharing that, is Any ritual that you have that helps you not take for granted every single breath between the precious first one and the precious last one, so that we have some glimpse of what we can do for not taking our breaths for granted. Thank you.
Well, last year I wrote a little book called Letters to Pope Francis. And in it, I remind him that he picked the name Francis, the first pope ever to pick it. And, of course, I lay out some of the teachings and modeling of Francis in his life. And there are three things especially, I think, that stand out. And I give this pope some credit for trying to live up to them. First of all is, of course, ecology and the relationship to plant world and animal world. That Francis of Assisi was very Celtic in that respect. He found the Christ in the wolf and the Christ in the plants and so forth. And in his brilliant poem, Brother, Sun, Sister, Moon, Christ is not mentioned once. And yet it's a theophany of creation. So he was very creation-centered, very much from the wisdom tradition of Israel, which scholars now agree Jesus came from as well. In the wisdom tradition, God is found not so much in a book as in nature. Nature itself is revelation. Francis was very aware of that. He tasted it. The second dimension of Francis is, of course, his awareness of poverty and class distinction. His father was a very, very successful businessman when business was just getting off the ground in the late 12th century. And he had to break with his father. His father actually built a dungeon in the basement and put his son into it for quite a while. His mother let him loose after a while. But then you may know if you saw that movie of Francis that he actually went to the town square, took off all his clothes and said, I don't have a father anymore. Only God is my father. So he broke with capitalism just like that, just as capitalism was getting off the ground. And he said he betrothed Lady Poverty. So he lived a life of simplicity and poverty, whereas he could have inherited his father was the most successful businessman in town, and he could have inherited all that, etc., etc. But the third dimension to Francis that I think really needs attention, and I don't think, and I give this present pope credit, by the way, for taking on Wall Street and so forth. He has some very strong language that, frankly, one would expect from a third world citizen about savage capitalism is one of his phrases and so forth. I mean, he really he's really keen on that issue. But I think the third issue is harder for him because he's a Jesuit, and that is the feminine side of divinity. So in his poem, Brother Sun, Sister Moon, if you read it, each stanza goes from masculine to feminine, or feminine to masculine, and feminine to masculine. There's an incredible balance in this guy's psyche. And it's coming from him. This is not, he's not quoting someone else. This is his poem. You got to reread it. It's Mother Earth and Brother Stone and so forth. It's just an amazing gender balance going on in this guy's psyche. And it's so needed today. And as I say, you know, the Jesuits have no female wing to their order, unlike many other orders in the Western Church, like Dominicans, Franciscans, Benedictines, Carmelites. They have men and women, but not the Jesuits, because Ignatius was a 16th century genius and a soldier, and the 16th century was notoriously mega masculine. Think, for example, of Michelangelo's paintings, even of women. His women look like they posed for the Arm & Hammer baking soda cover. You know, they're all, you know, they work out 24/7, I think. So, and the 16th century, of course, launched the colonization of the world. You know, it was a very masculine time. And of course, and it beat up on all these indigenous wisdom traditions. One scholar has named Native American religion as Aboriginal mother love. Well, when the Europeans came over, they obliterated or tried to obliterate Aboriginal mother love, because the energy was so masculine that they were threatened by what they, of course, projected and called, quote, savages, unquote. So I think that third dimension to Francis is more subtle, and for this particular pope named Francis, also harder for him to grasp, because Jesuits as a group tend to be not too sensitive to the feminine. But Francis created a revolution because he rejected, on the one hand, the feudal system that had been running Europe for centuries, but he also rejected this new thing called capitalism that his father was one of the avant-garde pioneers of. He said there has to be a middle way. There has to be we don't want the privileges of the feudal system for a few, but neither do we want the idolatry of money, which, by the way, is a phrase that Pope Francis has used on several occasions, to run things either. We've got to find something in between. And it has something to do with finding our relationship to the other beings, to the plants and the animals and the stones, to Mother Earth. It has to do with something with that. You see, he had this ecological consciousness, and I really think he was saying, let's build an economics on this. And as I alluded to earlier, I think that's where we are as a species now. If we don't build an economics on ecology, and of course they come from the same word, eco means home, whether it's economics or ecology, it's about home. That's the Greek word for home. This could be the basis. And this is what I love about David Corton's work. He's done his homework beyond economics. He knows the new ecology. He knows the new cosmology. Remember what Thomas Berry says, ecology is functional cosmology. So to get a new cosmology, which is what we're getting from science today, is to fill us with all kinds of images and possibilities for a more ecological and therefore sustainable way of living, you know. So those are a few thoughts about Francis. It is interesting how he's captured the hearts of so many people, and people who visit Assisi. I've met many people who've had conversion experiences there in their own lives, encountering Francis there. So then your second question was about... Ritual to honor. Well, of course, a very simple thing, of course, is to meditate on every breath. And, of course, remember the word for breath, not only in the biblical languages, but around the world, is, and spirit and breath are the same words. In many African languages, spirit, breath, and dance are the same basic words, which makes sense because it's kind of hard to dance without breath. And you really have to be thick-headed to dance without spirit. So remember that breath is spirit. Now, spirit is usually invisible, but on a cold day, you can see your breath. Or if you're praying with native people, the sacred pipe, part of the genius of the sacred pipe is that your breath turns into smoke. And smoke rises to the heavens, thus connecting the heavens and the earth. So there are these practices that are just full of archetypal invitations. But I think just meditating on something ever so simple, for example, to go out and pick a leaf and to spend time with the leaf. And, of course, remember that every leaf is 13.8 billion years old. It has a story to tell you. And, of course, you're that old, too. So meditate on your hand. And remember that 60% of the atoms of your body are hydrogen atoms that were birthed in the original fireball 13.8 billion years ago. So that means more than half of you is 13.8 billion years old. And then the rest of you was birthed in a supernova explosion 4 or 5 billion years ago. The sulfur, the carbon, the magnesium, and so forth. So to take the new science, the new cosmology, and meditate on it and turn it into meditation, because, and as I said earlier, this empty chair, to
to realize that the miracle that you're here instead of someone else, with all your weaknesses and all your uniqueness and all your strength, to realize how unique you are and your journey has been for 13.8 billion years. So this is another way of combining left and right brain. Read the new cosmology and then start praying the new cosmology. We have to pray it. Put it into our hearts and imaginations.
We have time just for a couple more questions and reflections. It's that time of night. Okay, in the flow then. I know we'll take one over here, and I know Pancho had one up front. Yes, thank you so much for your talk. It's been churning a lot in my stomach, actually, as I was sitting this time. Both, you know, just a lot of thought, and also I've actually what you mentioned about spirit and dance reminded me of what Anna Halprin, she's a modern dance pioneer, and what she said about how dance is the breath made visible. And I myself have been, you know, really experiencing an awakening through dance. I study expressive arts therapy, and that's what I really want to transition into as a livelihood, but also as a path and as a just really feeling that connection with all beings through the body. But one thing I'm struggling with right now is sometimes this idea that, you know, like, well, there's a lot of healing to do, there's a lot of grieving to do, and part of my, you know, what I'm interested in therapy and just is to facilitate that process. But then after that, I had the question of, like, but then what else? What after that? Like, when, you know, will we ever be able to heal fast enough? Or just it seems that there's constant barrage of, like, wounding that's happening, and then I start to feel like, well, you know, maybe I need to get more political, or just feeling very lost, and just all the, not having the sense of not being able to keep up, or just there's so many changes, so much destruction, and just like, where do I fit in that? Where, you know, how do I feel that what I'm doing is enough, or that will it ever be enough? And just, you know, like that, the dance helps me move through that sometimes, but there's also moments when I do feel like a little bit at a crossroads, or just paralyzed by that sense that will I ever find something that's enough? So my question is just related to how you have moved through that in your own life.
Well, first of all, I want to commend the path you're on. I do think that many people have been called today to be healers and to enter into art as a spiritual practice, which I hear you telling us you're doing through your dance. And, of course, other arts too, filmmaking and music and poetry and writing. And so that alone, I think, is very good news. I think your question about is it enough and so forth, and can I get over? I can get overwhelmed. Also, I think those are very important questions for any warrior or prophet to ask. I think every prophet, every warrior has doubts about what they are called to do and whether they're doing enough and so forth. So I think this is where you also have to return your vocation, because that's what you're talking about. Your calling, you know, to the source. Who in your mind is doing the calling? You know, is it future generations? Is it the ancestors? Is it God, if you use that word? Is it spirit? Is it Mother Earth? Because the one who's doing the calling also has to help you to ground. And you need grounding. So you want to ground in whatever source that is for you. Thomas Aquinas says, God is the source without a source, which I think is a marvelous naming of something that's unnameable. It's a very feminist naming too, the source. But my point is that that's what prayer is about, to ground you. And as this gentleman mentioned, you know, it's not about getting something. Eckhart talks about that. He says most people think of God like they do a cow, for the amount of cheese and milk they can get. This commercial thing that you alluded to, and that misses the whole point. God's not a cow delivering cheese and milk. God is the being within the being. And your question is a deep question about being. First of all, you want to keep your own being grounded so that you can be an effective warrior or effective agent of transformation. But of course, we all suffer that you know, reading the news is enough to make you wonder, you know, am I doing enough? Or should I jump off a building or something? So you have to, that's why the Via Positiva is very important. You have to keep filling yourself up with the source, with joy, with awe, with gratitude. And that keeps you going. And not to spend a lot of time second-guessing yourself. But you do want to ask from time to time, you know, is this path the best I could do? Is this the right path for me to be on now? Like I said, when I left my university, I didn't know what was left, what was next. So I asked, and it came to me. It worked with the teenagers, inner-city teenagers. So, you know, that's what prayer is. It's about addressing the source and finding ways to ground yourself. And, of course, finding allies, friends, community. We're not in this alone. And we're all suffering these questions and these thoughts today. Am I doing too much? Is it too much? You know, this is part of living in tumultuous times. The sad thing would be if you were 100% sure of the path you're on. That would be scary. That's zealotry, and that is scary. So be thankful for the doubts that you have at the same time that you do learn ways to ground yourself and to return to the source periodically, and to find allies, to find others who can help you to laugh at yourself and our journeys and what Adrian Rich calls our blind mischances. That we shouldn't begin with the lofty view of ourselves. We should begin like Francis does, with simplicity. And no one of us is going to save the world. All we have to do is try. But the process itself should be fun. It should be joyful and it should be fun. Because otherwise we're just holding our breath for the next 5-year plan or something. And the way, the path, we talked earlier about the phrase that Christ is the way, but the path and the way must carry some of the eschatological joy and hope, and also spontaneity and childlikeness and foolishness and play. That is our goal as well, you know?
Well, Jai Jagat, Gloria al Planeta, glory to the planet. Just reminded that Francis of Assisi, well, this attributed to him, that he said that preach the gospel all times and use words if necessary. Mm-hmm. And I just look around this room and there are so many wonderful teachers around here, and many of you, know that I've been a very sharp criticized of the Western syndrome, and it's not a culture, it's a syndrome. But now it led to honor, have all these great teachers like our beloved Betty Peck there, to put in, herself in the line to defend weeds in a nonviolent way, or how her brother Steve Carling there to help us to remember to honor the two-legged ones, but also the winged ones and the creepy crawling ones, and Brother John to keep it, help us to keep it things real, these inner kids. And there's so many wonderful teachers here, and of course the courage to have this home to open to any one of you to be here. And I just want to point that as someone that really is a student of nonviolence and fearlessness, as I consider this sack of bones, I have a lot of love and admiration and respect and inspiration coming from you. But it's no easy thing to have the same inquisition breathing in your neck, and to keep anchor on that universal love and that courage that it takes to keep going no matter what. It's a lot. So I don't know if you have a brief sharing about how is that you keep that courage anchor in universal love.
Well, I don't think any of us can be spiritual warriors, which is what we all need to be today, without courage. Courage is so necessary. So what is courage? Well, of course, it's two French words, cœur large. It's a big heart. So it goes back to the via positiva. It's about being in love. If you're in love enough, you're going to be strong. Dr. King was once asked, how can you march in Skokie, Illinois, knowing people want to kill you? And his answer was, you have to love something more than the fear of death if you're going to live. Now, the fear of death may mean the fear of losing your job or your reputation or a relationship or something else. So fear is not compatible with either love or courage. The Gospels say love drives out fear. And every prophet has learned to develop his or her muscles of courage, if you will. And it's about falling more deeply in love. So I like to tell this story about Fred Shuttlesworth, who was an African-American minister, street minister, during the civil rights times in Birmingham. And unlike King, he was not from the educated class. He was a street guy. But he was very smart and very committed. And it was he who convinced King to fill the jails with teenagers, because the adults had been in jail almost a month, and he said, you know, if these guys stay in jail much longer, they're going to lose their jobs, and it's not going to do the movement any good. So we have to let them out of jail and get the teenagers in there. And King didn't want to do that, but he yielded, and Fred Shuttlesworth was right. Now, Fred Shuttlesworth was beaten 3 times with chains by the Ku Klux Klan. His children, 8 and 10 years old, were arrested by the sheriff and put in jail. And his house was blown up by the Ku Klux Klan. And he walked out of it alive. The whole roof had caved in. So I was invited a few years ago to dialogue with him in the Civil Rights Museum in Birmingham, which is right across the street from that black church which the Ku Klux Klan blew up on a Sunday and killed 5 or 6 black girls on a Sunday morning. So now they have a civil rights museum right across the street. And they asked me to come and dialogue with him about racism and ecology. And he was like 80 years old or so, but still fighting a good fight. And this was kind of a new topic 10 or 12 years ago in the black community, really. And so before we did our public dialogue, we were having a little lunch together, sharing a sandwich in the back room. And I said to him, Fred, where did you get your courage? And his answer was this. He said, when I walked out of that house alive, they had blown up, he said, I knew they couldn't kill me, and they couldn't kill the movement. They might kill my body, but they could never kill my soul or the movement. So he said, you can call it courage, but I don't call it courage. He says, I call it trust. And to me, that takes me back to the point of making you. We have to learn to trust the source, to trust the universe. Trust the fact that you have been on a 13.8 billion year journey. You've gotten this far. There's a reason you're here. The reason you're here in this empty chair does not house someone else instead. So that trust has to be both of yourself and of the powers that be, if you will. And I think that's where courage comes from. Plus being in love. I tell our students, you have to fall in love at least 3 times a day. Now, we have to de-anthropocentrize this falling in love thing. Because we're taught in our culture, oh, falling in love is about finding a mate until death do you part. No, it's about much more than that. You can fall in love with wildflowers. You can fall in love with trees. You can fall in love with fishes. You can fall in love with poetry, with music, with people different from yourself and people like yourself. And, you know, it's just a banquet of lovable beings. And the Christ, the Buddha nature, God is in every one of them. But you got to give it your heart and take the time. I love this line from Baudelaire, the French artist in the 19th century. He says, "We walk through forests, plural, forests of physical things, but also spiritual things that look on us with affectionate looks." You know, we're beginning to reach, I think, the realization of how loved we are by other beings on the planet. Because we wouldn't be here. You know, the flowers 100 million years ago started processing the oxygen and got it just right for people like ourselves. So they must love us a lot. The trees were the first ones to leave the ocean and contradict gravity and develop a circulatory system and show us that you can stand up out of the ocean and survive. So they must love us a lot. The rocks, they're the oldest creatures on earth. If you've ever been in a sweat lodge, you know what the rocks have to teach you. They're the wisest and the oldest elders we got. So, you know, we're surrounded by love. How can we not be courageous? Because courage is just a return of love for love. And that makes the heart grow larger. And that's what courage is. So thank you, Pancho, for... Pancho is the one who introduced me to this wonderful organization and movement. So, and invited me, and I want to thank him. I want to thank the wonderful cooks tonight. That was marvelous. Yes, indeed. It was kind of miraculous how everyone got fed so rapidly, and there was no hullabaloo back there. I mean, it reminded me of the loaves and the fishes in the Jesus story. Everyone ate, and there's stuff left over. So, and no one was left out. So, I want to thank you all for your attendance, and above all for the inner work that you're doing. Our species will not survive without people doing their inner work, and the inner work is where it's going to take us back to appreciation and awe and being and also courage and imagination, you know, to make a difference and to link up with all these wonderful allies. So thank you for sharing your faces with me tonight.
Beautiful. And just a very fitting way to close the evening. I know there are more questions in the room, so I apologize to those who didn't get a chance to ask their question this time. And I'm actually going to steal the last question very quickly and ask it really on behalf of everyone in this room. Matthew, what can we do to serve your journey?
Well, thank you for the question. Well, I certainly would appreciate your prayers, the extension of your support that way. And that's the most important. And just your continued integrity of your own journeys. And I hope the older ones reach out to the younger ones. I really think we need intergenerational wisdom today like never before. In a book I did recently, Occupy Spirituality, it's about 20-somethings, young adults in spirituality. And we did surveys of a lot of young adults. One of the questions we asked was about elders. Do you want elders in your life, and do you have them? 98% said we want them and we can't find them. And when we do, they talk too much, they said. So I think it's something you really have to be conscious of. For example, and it's very simple what you could do. You could just put an ad on the Craigslist or something and say, we're going to meet Tuesday night, old and young adults together. And no agenda, just share some stories. And, you know, we've got to get this thing going because, you know, one of the most exciting studies I learned about this past year was a study conducted by a woman scientist and her team about Neanderthals. What? About Neanderthals. You know, the story we had for decades was, well, our ancestors beat up the Neanderthals in a war, and that's why they're gone and we're here. But in fact, what they found is that a lot of us are walking around with DNA, Neanderthal DNA in us. So clearly we were doing more than having war. So what she found is this, that the Neanderthals only lived to be about 29 or 30 years old. In other words, they had no grandparents. They had no elders. Whereas our species had elders. We lived long enough for there to be three generations working together. I have goosebumps right now. To me, that's just very important information. It's not romanticism. It's a scientific fact that a species that pays attention to intergenerational sharing and wisdom is much better off than one that doesn't. And we've lost a lot of that. We park our old ones in one retirement place. That's another thing. We have to retire the word retirement. The word should be refirement. When you come to that place in life and you no longer have to put food on the table for the next generation, rejoice for a day or two and then ask, what's the fire in your belly now? It's going to be different. And for a lot, it actually is a calling to work with the youngest, to work with the younger generation. We need refirement and rewirement. And the rewirement is what you're doing here today. It's meditation. It's taking care of your spiritual life and realizing that you've got to wire both brains, not just one brain. And all the chakras and the body, it's all got to be wired together. And so I thank you for your question. And, of course, you're very welcome to participate in our Cosmic Mass, or you can go on my webpage, MatthewFox.org, and there may be other things you want to participate in. And if you have an organization you want to have me over or something, I'm open to connecting that way too.
Thank you. We've heard so much about the importance and the significance of gratitude, and that is really one of the sacred rituals of this space, is to always close with gratitude. And we've been given a lot of keys of truth today to open doors with as we go forth from this room. And as I, you know, reflect on this space, Matthew talked earlier of Burning Man and how irrational it was that people in August went to the desert, tens of thousands of them. And, you know, there's something irrational about people in the middle of Silicon Valley coming to a living room in the middle of the week on a work night to sit in silence together. And there's something very irrational about the people who hold this space and have been holding this space for close on 17 years now, every week, and who've opened it up to whoever comes in and treated every stranger who walks through that door as family, as beloved family. And that is my mother-in-law over there behind the counter, and my father-in-law sitting here by my side. And 17 years ago with Nipun and Guri, they sat down to gather silence, as Matthew so eloquently put it. You know, and this is what it has grown into over 17 years, week by week. It's been a beautiful journey, and one thing they constantly are aware of is that this isn't the creation of the people who live in this house 7 days a week. It is co-created by every single stream that comes in. And so there's a deep gratitude for each one of you who chose to spend this time and space together with us. You know, it's a blip on the radar in our 13 point whatever billion years of lifetime, the space that we spend here. And it's also so improbable that we would get this opportunity. And so it is with that, you know, that deep gratitude that we will close our eyes and kind of beam that out, you know, past the four walls of this room to wherever it needs to go in this world. Thank you all for being here.